Good evening, everyone. I'm Joseph Cotto. Joining me tonight is the one, the only, Paul Gottfried, called by some the Godfather. Paul, how's it going?
Everything is fine. It's, in fact, we even have warm weather here today.
Yeah, you do. I noticed that. We have warmer than usual weather here, too, even though it's been cooler than usual for the last week or so. I really like the cool weather. I hope it goes back to coolness. Paul, I mean, everybody should know who Paul is by now. If they don't, it's kind of unfortunate. But Paul, in case people don't know, is the chief editor of Chronicles. He also writes for The Blaze. And he is the Horace Raffensperger Emeritus Professor of Humanities at Elizabethtown College. And he is regarded by many as being the foremost paleoconservative intellectual around today, in addition to being arguably one of the most intelligent and substantive intellectuals alive, period. Paul, did I get all that correct?
You have most of it correct. The idea of being the most important paleoconservative in intellectual is a somewhat somewhat ambiguous, problematic title, since probably several other people who disagree with me would claim the same honor. And curiously, paleoconservatives are so open to discussion, although we're generally on the right, that we disagree among ourselves. And I cannot claim that I speak for the position of other paleoconservatives on many matters.
Well, I do agree with the idea that you are the most important of them all, and I will just state that very clearly. Tonight, we're going to discuss two articles you wrote for The Blaze, and obviously they pertain to economics and business. The first one is titled, Am I a Right-Wing Marxist? This was published on the 27th of November, obviously of this year. And the article begins after, the title, the question in the title. Well, no, but my friends on the populist right and I have no interest in another recycled pep talk about the permanent things or seminars about lowering corporate taxes or waging wars for democracy. I think, Paul, there's no question as to where you're going here. Please explain the premise of the article and why it's so timely.
Well, I think that the context of the article is important. There was a piece that was published in Law and Liberty by somebody who works for the Kirk Foundation, attacking paleoconservatives generally, and me specifically, of being a right-wing Marxist. And this came, apropos of a discussion of an anthology that I edited on paleoconservatism. And I read through this polemic, and it was obviously aimed at sort of pushing us out of the conservative movement. But as you read it, it was obvious that this person was also going after the entire populist right, including MAGA Republicans, and basically was coming, one might say, from what you might describe as a rhino Republican position. It's kind of Mitt Romney Republican, who was condemning everything that was boisterous and anti-establishment on the right. But I thought the accusation that he made against us of being right-wing Marxist was interesting, because we're usually attacked as being on the archaic right or something like that. The reality is that paleoconservatives have generally been populist. Then they've supported the American working class. Sometimes we may, in fact, sound like Marxists. I can't deny this. However, we are obviously coming from the right. Even when we are critical of capitalists, we are usually critical from a cultural, moral position, which is unmistakably, that of the intellectual right. So I would not, by the way, have objected if this person's intention were to open up a discussion, but it was not. It was, an attempt to just slam us in order to ingratiate himself with the conservative establishment. But later on, when I thought about it, I said, there might even be some truth in what he was saying, or just enough truth. And one of our contributors, Grant Havers, who's in Canada, he's a professor there, wrote me and said, There may be a point here that we have been very critical of corporate capitalism, particularly its politics. Mm-hmm. I think we also, criticize capitalism as it is practiced, mm-hmm. Not as a pure theory. Mm-hmm. But, it's very hard to divorce wokeness, what happened with Budweiser Light, what is happening with Target and other large capitalist ventures from capitalism itself. This is the way capitalism is practiced in our time. And, it deserves to be criticized for cultural reasons and also for economic reasons, since the American working class and small-town Americans are in a horrible condition, horrible state right now, mm-hmm. Partly owing to the way the government treats them.
So looking at these companies, I think it's fair to say you're talking about woke capital, which definitely has a massive, massive presence among the largest corporations mm-hmm. out there. Mm-hmm. Looking at woke capital, when it goes too far, it loses money. You see that with Disney. Its stock value has plummeted. Mm-hmm. The company is in a really bad situation right now, to say the least. And it looks like it's going to get worse because it has several projects in the pipeline that are due to be released, which will reflect the unpopular sensibility, at least among Disney's target audience, of those who made the movies. And obviously, these people who made these movies were egged on by the company at its highest levels. So Disney is in a bad situation. But the question is, even though Bob Iger, the CEO, said that he wants to go in a less culture warrior direction, the question is, will these companies actually turn themselves around even though they're losing money? They still are very powerful. They're very mm-hmm. influential. But will they respond to the market? What do you think?
In some cases, yes. But those cases are far and few between. Mm-hmm. Like Budweiser is a case that people always point to. Mm-hmm. Disney, I doubt they're going to do very much. Mm-hmm. So, they think they have a deep investment in wokeness, mm-hmm. and they're sort of taking on Ron DeSantis, who's going against them, and they have the Democratic Party behind them, mm-hmm. which hates DeSantis because he is a genuine conservative, there are just so many of those corporations. You don't even know where to begin. Uh-huh. As you start with Coca-Cola, Citibank, there's lots of them that are doing this. And typically support is sort of the middle management people mm-hmm. who graduate from elite universities who, if they are married to women as opposed to members of their own sex, are usually radicalized by their spouses. The women seem to be far more radical than the men. In these situations where couples become woke, I think the problems are massive. Even if occasionally, there's another piece that I wrote about even the lack of public awareness of what's going on. That it was about. I wrote something about the giant supermarkets in our area, mm-hmm. and they're owned by people who are on the far left, unbeknownst to my neighbors who mostly voted for Donald Trump, mm-hmm. but you go and they have big signs. We need help, and they have a black woman. Mm-hmm. And I raised this question: you need help. There's a black woman, white man. You hire the person you need. I mean, I was raised in a society where if a black person was capable of taking a job, my father had a black person working for him. He was not a civil rights warrior. He just thought the person was fine and hired him. You hire the person whom you think can fill the job. But no, they're telling you, we don't want white people. We want black women. And you think somebody would get pissed off, but they don't. I'm the only one who probably noticed this. Although my friend Alex Riley, who lives up in, teaches at Bucknell, said he noticed it when he walked in. He said, there's hardly any blacks in the area. But mm-hmm. they obviously are doing this, and they're really spitting in the face of white men. But mm-hmm. I may be the only one who even cares about it.
We will get to that article. I mean, it's fascinating. The core of corporate wokeness, it's hard to say that there is there is obviously a core. There has to be a core to everything. But it has many moving parts, I'll put it that way, corporate wokeness. Mm-hmm. But the most identifiable aspect of its core would be the CEI system, which is brought out by the Human Rights Campaign. There was an article written about this in the New York Post earlier this year. I read a bit of it, and you can share your views on the situation. Executives at companies like Nike, Anheuser-Busch, and Kate Spade, whose brand endorsements have turned controversial trans influencer Dylan Mulvaney into today's woke it girl, aren't just virtue signaling. They're handing out lucrative deals to what were once considered fringe celebrities because they have to, or risk failing an all-important social credit score that could make or break their business. At stake is their Corporate Equality Index, or CEI score, which is overseen by the Human Rights Campaign, the largest LGBTQ plus political lobbying group in the world. HRC, which has received millions from George Soros' Open Society Foundation, among others, issues report cards for America's biggest corporations via the CEI, awarding or subtracting points for how well companies adhere to what HRC calls its ratings criteria. Businesses that attain the maximum 100 total points earn the coveted title Best Place to Work for LGBTQ Equality. 15 of the top 20 Fortune-ranked companies received 100% ratings last year. I'll stop there. So this is really interesting. It goes to show literally how these companies are being scored. And obviously, if one gets a low score, the idea is to have this company publicly shamed and isolated. At least that's where the HRC is coming from. And what this would mean in real time is that people would not invest in the company because they would not want to be seen in the company of a company that is perceived as being anti, quote unquote, human rights. Of course, I think this is all ridiculous. I don't think the scoring system serves any productive purpose whatsoever. It's basically designed to cajole companies into taking unpopular stances, even if it loses them money, because if they're losing their consumer base, they also have to fear about losing their investor base. And if they can keep the investor base while losing the consumer base, they hope to go on basically in a weakened state. But at the end of the day, the investor base should not be pressured by politics. It should be about whether or not the company's fundamentals are strong, and that goes back to the marketplace. So what this Corporate Equality Index is basically an incursion into the market, into the, you could say, free market. Some people associate it with free trade. That's really not what I'm getting into. But it is, for the purpose of the domestic marketplace, this Equality Index, it is an incursion into the free market system, wherein politics becomes a source of agitation for people who would otherwise be focused on what consumers want. And it's sort of like usurping capitalism. So a lot of people look at this and say, well, this wokeness is a failure of capitalism. I would say it's a failure of capitalism being rated, if you will, by political ideologues. So it's not really about people, it's not really about the system which people use to get goods and services they want failing. It's about the system being hacked, essentially. That's what's going on here. Paul, anything to say about this?
Yeah, I happen to have read the same article you did, and I actually wrote a column on this.
Oh,
bringing
great.
Up some of the same points you mentioned. I do have problems saying this has nothing to do with capitalism. It's, some kind of bad ideological force that just, but it's sort of hard for me to differentiate any longer between the way capitalism is practiced and, some kind of pure theory that probably never existed in fact. And I don't think the answer is socialism, obviously, but I think that one of the answers that has very, very clearly presented itself is for conservative governments to disinvest. And in West Virginia, I spoke to the several officials of that government, and they have disinvested in woke companies in their state. They've taken all retirement money out.
Mm-hmm. That they have. And yeah, other
Texas
states
has done the same. Others, Florida's doing this.
Yes.
Thanks to your fine governor. And this is happening in many states in the United States, and they're going to lose money. And I think if we had the right person in the White House, And the right person, as you know, I think is DeSantis. I would be happy if Trump did something like this. I just don't trust him. But you know, you can't make them feel the effects of this Nazi ideological intolerance. I mean, this is unbelievable what these people are doing. To browbeat smaller capitalists into accepting this this totalitarian woke ideology of theirs. And but I would be quite happy to use the instruments of government, and certainly state governments, to make these people pay for their disgusting behavior.
I support states divesting from woke companies. I'm not opposed to that at all. I obviously am not on the DeSantis train, even though I voted for him for lack of better options. But one thing he has done, certainly, that I agree with, is going after woke capital. Even in the beginning, him going after Disney was great because Disney was trying to force his perspective on the state legislature. We were very aggressive, over-the-top means, and that had to be counteracted, and it was. But then DeSantis took it too far after the fact. But, you know, at the end of the day, woke capitalism is something very real. I'm not saying it's, you know, a fantasy. But I do think that what's happening here is not so much a failure of capitalism as the system. Rather, it shows how it can be exploited. So the question is, how does one remove the opportunity for exploitation? When I say it's exploitative, like I said before, it's like being hacked. It's being hacked by these political ideologues who are trying to use it for their own purposes rather than trying to further a system that gives people the goods and services they want through competition as cheaply as possible. This really is something else. And I do think state action, as I've been saying, is warranted in trying to deal with this hacking of the system, so to speak. Now, for those who might wonder how this human rights campaign corporate equality index works. As I mentioned, it does operate on a 100-point system. So if a company gets 5 points for what are called workforce protections, which means that there can't be any discrimination in the hiring process on the basis of sexual orientation or how one identifies in terms of gender. And I will just say that this is a pretty basic thing. More or less, any company that adheres to anti-discrimination laws, we get the 5 points. Although I'm sure the HRC takes things further than the law, so I need to be clear about that one. I'm sure HRC would probably define this in some over-the-top way, even just to get 5 points, that you know, companies, even if they adhere to the law in totality, which I'm sure all of them do, all of the big companies that HRC scores, they still might wind up with a zero. So I'm just throwing that out there. The next thing is inclusive benefits. That's 50 points. That's a big one. And that means that the company provides healthcare services for non-heterosexual couples. Now, I am sure that this, once again, is something that goes way beyond whatever the law requires, because obviously the law, it's illegal across the country for any company to say, hey, we're not going to give healthcare benefits to this gay couple, whereas it's given to a heterosexual couple. No company does that. But I'm sure what HRC is talking about is stuff like, you know, does the company pay for a policy that allows for the child of an employee to transition from a male to a female at age 6. I think HRC takes it that far, knowing the organization. So the 50 points thing, definitely, I think in order to get that, you have to go farther than way beyond whatever the law requires. Because if they were just talking about what the law requires, then everybody would be getting it. Then the next thing is called supporting an inclusive culture. That's 25 points. And that refers to having gender-neutral dress codes, as well as inclusive restrooms and facilities for trans people. I'm sure it includes a hell of a lot more than that. So this is where it really gets into, it was getting crazy before, but now is where it gets into this sort of aggressive, in-your-face thing. It's not just about behind-the-scenes stuff like, you know, worker benefits or, you know, what happens in a human resources office between an employee and the employer. So now when you talk about this cultural aspect, which once again is 25 points, this is where it gets hyper aggressive. Not to say it wasn't aggressive before. And we are now up to 80 points, 50 for inclusive benefits, 5 for workforce protections, 25 for inclusive culture. now for the last 20 points, even though there's another one, we'll get to that, is corporate social responsibility. This refers explicitly to, per the HRC, marketing or advertising to LGBTQ consumers. And now I will say this is where the whole Dylan Mulvaney thing comes in. Because in order to get the score, Bud Light had to throw something out there, even though it radically offended its consumer base, it had to throw something out there so basically the HRC would not lob 20 points off its score. And once again, if a company has a low enough score, this means a lot of investors, particularly big investors, don't want to go near the company because they are concerned that basically the woke mob might come after them. It's a terrible, terrible thing. I'm obviously not defending it, but I'm just telling you what's going on. It's really awful. Finally, the last aspect of the scoring is responsible citizenship. This is negative 25 points. A company can get up to 25 points taken away if they fund, quote, this is from HRC, organizations whose primary mission includes advocacy against LGBTQ equality, end quote. So obviously this means that if any company gives anything to a conservative group, they get the 25 points taken away from them, even if they would have scored a perfect 100 otherwise. So this is really an effort of coercion. The design is to make the company as left-wing as possible, as quickly as possible. It's a year-to-year thing, and it's very serious. It's tremendously serious. It is a problem, and it's such a big problem that state action, I think, to deal with this is not a bad thing. Obviously, the state shouldn't go in and prevent HRC from doing its scoring, but a state divesting in companies that go too far in this, shall we say, quote-unquote, equality index direction, and states which, you know, begin to take stances against certain governments, state-level governments or even local governments, which are really taking a stance against the people who elected these governments, who are the people that these companies are supposed to be serving. I don't mind certain state action then for divestment and to promote real anti-discrimination policies. So that's the situation here. I will just say the big three investment firms, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street Bank, they are the foremost shareholders when it comes to the majority of publicly traded corporations in America. And they really like the CEI, Corporate Equality Index. So companies have to worry about these three asset managers pulling funds from them if they run afoul of HRC. So this is what I was saying before, that they have to deal with investors as well as the market, when if there were not this political pressure, the investors in the market would be at one because everyone would want to make money. But then if capitalism is hacked, as we see, it becomes about promoting an ideology at the expense of turning a profit. And that's not good. Paul, anything to say about what I brought up?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned BlackRock is one of the large corporations that push the DEI agenda. Interestingly enough, they advertise all the time on Fox News, and you know, which reaches a predominantly, I think, at least 75% Republican audience. And I think they do try to have it like both ways. But BlackRock also has been one of the companies that I that my friend who deals with those things in West Virginia told me, you know, they disinvest from. Because everyone knows that the agenda that they're pushing. To me, what is remarkable about this is that I spent a good deal of my life attacking government attempts to impose anti-discrimination directives on private enterprise, getting involved in hiring, and of course I oppose this. I think it's a way by which the government nationalizes, controls, and imposes what the Germans call ideologische Gleichschaltung, you know, a kind of ideological integration of all things, you know, into the ideology of the state. I think this has all happened. What is interesting now, however, is it's not so much the state, it's the capitalist sector which is doing this to itself. Mm-hmm. And I find myself in the unusual position of wanting a right-wing government that will step in and smash them for doing this. So I'm sort of calling on the state, you know, to do this, because we're dealing with rogue capitalism, which is using its influence to destroy traditional morality, traditional social relations, and to punish people for being normal. And I think a lot of what I've written about the state by now is sort of prehistory, because we see this now coming from the corporate sector, primarily from the corporate sector. Even if the deep state were to go away and all the things that we on the right would like to see happen, we were still faced by a culturally radicalized totalitarian corporate capitalist sector, which has to be dealt with by somebody. I agree with you. The action of these states in disinvesting, to me, you know, is a no-brainer. I mean, that's where you start. Wherever else, you know, it ends up is another thing. But I think if you can do this at the state level and take away their retirement funds, other stuff the state controls, which have been going to these rogue capitalists, I think that would be a useful first step. The idea of alerting people, you know, so they all go ahead and they boycott these companies, things that I've been calling for years, maybe a blind alley in the end, because just so many people doing it at a very high level, you know. So, I mean, if I say I'm going to stop shopping at my local Giant because I don't like the sign, you know, I'm really not doing much to improve the situation, am I? Particularly if nobody else seems to care, even though my article on this went viral, but still, you know, that's only a small percentage of people who probably, you know, shop at Giant throughout the state. And the Giant in the Washington area, I think it may be run by somebody who is related to the Giant that operates out of Carlisle, Pennsylvania. That's equally radical from what I hear. So in any case, a local boycott would end up hurting the people I want to help, you know, in my own community, who need those jobs. So I'm not sure the boy, but I think disinvesting does work. I think that's, you know, you're hurting the people at the top by doing that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, disinvestment is much better than a local boycott for the reasons you mentioned. One thing you brought up in the article titled, Am I a Right-Wing Marxist, is that we doubt that we can win our social and cultural war by telling ourselves that we are now the freest society in human history. New strategies must be pursued for dealing with leftist class domination. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. What did you mean by that exactly?
Well, you know, I'm sort of listening to the Republican Party and its neoconservative foreign policy and getting sick to my stomach when I do that. They'll say, well, this is wrong in the country, and this isn't working well, and crime is high, and there is this war against white people, and go on and on, and against masculinity, and, you know, things are looking terrible. Then this is the greatest country that ever existed. This is the high point of view. The same person will go from one position to the other. Listen to Laura Ingraham. She'll go from one position to the other, depending on what you're trying to elicit from your audience. If you want them to support a military operation, you know, in the name of American democracy, then you have to tell them this is a great country. We're the envy of the world, and we're put on this planet in order to do God's good work and to bring democracy to other countries, right? But then when you want the people to vote against the Democratic Party, you're saying everything is going to hell in a handbasket. And for years, I've been noticing this contradiction. It's also present among fundamentalist Christians. I hear this all the time, that they were living in the end days. Things can't get any worse. But this is the greatest country that ever existed. You know, you have to make up your mind which position you're going to take.
Absolutely. What do you think accounts for this indecisiveness?
Well, I think that very often they have conflicting objectives that they're pursuing. You know, you want them to vote for your party by telling them the other party is really turning America, you know, into a graveyard. Everything is getting worse and worse. But then you want them to support a war for democracy or something else you want to do. So you tell them this is the greatest country, and we live up to its ideals, and we've been called on to spread these ideals throughout the world. Mm-hmm. So Wait till I get a drink.
Sure. No, it's fascinating. It really is this stuff, because I've seen this indecisiveness myself. And there's no question that a lot of people on the right tend to have a very myopic view of the U.S. But then when, you know, something comes up, which is obviously terrible, they change course a bit. I'll put it that way. And when they change course, they become more open, you know, that goes without saying, to the idea that something is very, very wrong. But then they could go back to saying, you know, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, more or less if they're prompted to on an issue that they find emotionally resonant. So it's really a unique situation. And I don't think there's any one answer as to why there's this sort of disconnect among many conservatives, but it's definitely there.
Yeah, no, I think there is this American patriotism that motivates them. Although very often American patriotism is utterly obnoxious the way it expresses itself. You know, other people can love their country. They don't have to keep telling, this is the greatest country that ever existed. You know, and all the other countries are only we're good, we're virtuous. And I think this sort of comes out of a certain kind of nonconformist Protestant culture, which is integral to America, the American founding. I think it still influences us. And, you know, we're a holy nation, we're the city on the hill, and they buy into this stuff, but usually brings with it a disparagement of other countries. I mean, I can love my country. Why must I consider others, you know, politically, culturally inferior to myself? This is this reminds me of I hear this nonsense on Fox News, my answer is, have you really checked out all the other countries before you say, I mean, this is, I had a friend who's now deceased who kept saying English literature is the world's greatest literature. And I said, of course, you've read Chinese literature in Chinese and compared it. I mean, you know, these are, you say you've read this stuff, you're familiar with it, you like it, fine. But why must you degrade other countries and other societies as being inferior to your own? And this seems to be part of this, maybe nationalism. It's almost a kind of phony nationalism. But you hear it all the time. And, you know, I do not hear Israelis, by the way, sounding like that at all. Mm-hmm. Israelis will say, this is a Jewish state, and I've moved here, and it's our land, and this. They do not disparage other people's countries. Usually only disparage the Arabs unless they attack them. Why must American, at least the ones I hear on Fox, why are they constantly disparaging other societies as being somehow inferior to this society? And then the other thing is, if you believe that our society was once great, has a fine constitution, which I agree with, but it's now fallen on hard times, is a corrupt government, we're living in a police state, they tell you, and it's true, we are. Why must you say it's the greatest country on earth, it is, you know, the freest society, what you should be doing is calling attention to the problems at home that have to be addressed, instead of patting yourself on the back.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But obviously, you know, that requires something more than rhetoric, and a lot of people don't want to do that. The heavy lifting is always less advantageous. Excuse me, the big talking, I'll put it this way, is always more advantageous than doing the heavy lifting. And that is the bottom line. That's true across all societies, and America is just one of them. Presuming that America has anything so cohesive as a society today, which I would disagree with.
Yeah, the other point, which I think is obvious, is that the left hates America.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, but we know that they loathe this country. They loathe it for all the things that's good about it, because it's part of Western civilization, and has white people living in it, and these are all things, men living in it, all the things they hate. But the understandable response is saying, no, we're not bad, we're great, or something like that. I mean, it's quite possible to be critical of your own country and see where it's going, even while recognizing that these people who have taken it over are driving it into the ground, hate it for all the things that's good about the country, or have all the things that used to be good about our country. The answer is no, this is the greatest place. The answer is, you know, why have you messed it up the way you have? It used to be a great place. Why have you done this to our country?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a great question. Now, before we move on to the next article, which you've been speaking about a bit, but there is the concept you bring up of leftist class domination. I guess talk to us a bit about that, why you think it's a big deal, and perhaps what can be done to deal with it.
Yeah, you know, I did write a book about 15, 16 years ago called Multiculturalism and the Politics of Guilt. Mm-hmm. And since I wrote that book, I've been repudiating it more and more. Because I don't think the left is driven by guilt. Mm-hmm. I know I had this discussion with my friend Amy Wax, who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, the law school. And at one time she said, all these people feel guilt. And I said, I just haven't met them. Most leftists I know hate ordinary, normal people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what drives their life. They look down at them. They despise them. It's not that they like black people that they hardly ever speak to. Mm-hmm. It's they hate normal white people. And people go to church, Christians they hate in particular. But they just seem to hate. So they hate the white working class particularly here. And but the same thing in Europe, by the way. And the effect, of course, is the white working class has moved politically all the way to the right in every Western country. You know, this is. Because they know they are hated, you know, by the ruling class, and I do see, you know, I do see the evidence of what looks like a class war, although it's not driven by capitalists trying to hold on to their material, and I think it's driven primarily by ideology and by the desire of the ruling class to destroy those on whom it has turned its fire. Mm-hmm. Now, among the things that are terrible that they do is they encourage black people to be angry, to go after white people. They encourage high crime. They do nothing to stop it, and they do everything to incite the inner city, the lower classes, against other people. And of course, they're not the victims. The victim is some poor Korean shopkeeper somewhere, or some Orthodox Jew in Brooklyn. They don't suffer the consequences, of course. They live in nice neighborhoods and in guarded communities and so forth. But I think the thing that we're seeing primarily is class war, and it is one in which the dominant class is on the cultural left, not necessarily on the economic left. Because if you notice, all these, you know, they talk about woke capitalist and now they push AI. So the ruling class is not going to divest capitalists of money. This is utter nonsense. This is the kind of nonsense you read in the Wall Street Journal or here on Fox News. These people are not going to take anything. In fact, they're going to look after the rich. They're going to give them, you know, nice Green New Deal jobs and solar energy, all kinds of other things, electric cars they can make. They're not going to be hurt. The ones who are going to be hurt are the poor slobs who are losing their jobs in Detroit right now. Because the auto industry is firing people because they won't need them to build these electric vehicles. So, I mean, I see it's primarily war against the working class. When Biden tells you, I'm going to raise corporate taxes. Now, what does this mean? He's not going to hurt his friends who are giving him all this money because he's getting money from the wealthy. What he's telling you, in effect, is that I'm going to make them poor pay more money. But they'll take it out of the wages of the working class, and they'll make you pay for it afterwards by having to raise prices. That's exactly what I hear, right? And I have Marxist friends who tell me this, and they're absolutely correct. That's exactly what's happening. It's more class war. And I think this is exactly the way one has to approach this. And you have the same ruling classes, government workers, corporate capitalists, the globalist elements of the society in every Western country. Whether you're looking at France, certainly Germany, Belgium, the United States, Sweden, look anywhere in Western Europe, look at Canada, look at the Anglophone countries. Their social structure political structure looks very much like us. They are dominated. They are dominated by the woke ruling class in alliance with the corporate media. Which is the same in every Western country. I'll tell you, the same lies in every Western country. Mm-hmm. They just do it in different languages. Uh-huh. So I do think we're looking at a phenomenon of class war, even if it does not fit the classical Marxist description.
That's fascinating. Obviously, the new paradigm of class warfare. And I do agree with, by the way, your analysis. Now, moving on to the next article, also published at The Blaze, as I mentioned, a giant case of corporate bigotry. This was run on November the 20th. The article begins, corporations that discriminate against white people and males in their advertisements should have their products massively boycotted. What worked against Bud Light could work in other circumstances. I notice that every time I check myself out of a giant supermarket in central Pennsylvania, I see a poster indicating that this chain store is looking for new workers. When I then look at whom the employers have in mind as potential help, I behold a picture of a young black woman. This young woman looks cheerful and attractive, but that's not the point here. The store is obviously not interested in hiring white men or even necessarily black men. It seeks to give preferential employment treatment to black women. And lest anyone doubt its purpose, giant management underlines this preference with the picture that accompanies its help wanted sign. The help wanted poster is not exactly an inoffensive adornment. It is apparent that the grocery's management is virtue signaling and doing so in a very ugly way. It is building on the practice of our corporate capitalists who are removing white people, and particularly white males, from TV advertisements. Exceptions are made in these advertisements for white males with black spouses, for homosexual partners, or if it's possible to stick them into a group made up predominantly of approved minorities. So this is fascinating. Paul, obviously, I'm done reading. But you obviously point out something which is going on. This pertains to the woke advertising phenomenon, which has taken root over the last 10 years. It used to be very, very rare that you saw someone in an interracial marriage on a TV commercial or in a, you know, pictorial advertisement. But now it's everywhere. This really, you know, just came up basically since like 2013, but it reached critical mass, I'd say, starting in 2017 and obviously into the present day. Anything to say about what you wrote or my perspective on it?
Yeah, I was encouraging boycotts there. I thought it over, having after having published this piece. It dawned on me that these boycotts are probably not going to work, because you can't get enough people interested in doing this. I do find, by the way, the attempt to stick blacks and homosexuals into TV dramas, advertisement, I find it absolutely disgusting. I mean, they can't let up on this. And I give the example of Mary Queen of Scots being black and all of these people living in the 16th century. I mean, it goes on and on. And you know, there are also situation dramas in which you expect to find white people. It's very unlikely you find, like, you know, they're talking about people who run, I don't know, a ski lodge in Switzerland. You know, they're all black. Anything you see is, I mean, they probably think the average person who watches this is a low-grade moron, and you can do anything you want to control them. And in some countries like Germany, it actually works. But, you know, I have more respect for Americans. I don't think they can be that easily controlled. But, you know, they do this all the time. The funny thing about it is that, having known woke capitalists, they don't associate very often with blacks. Uh-huh. They just have them on TV, so, you know, you can look at them. I mean, it's virtue signaling for the other person, right? I mean, this is, you can see how nice we are. And I don't know exactly, what am I supposed to think when I see this? I mean, I know it's all made up. I know it's an attempt to browbeat me, to patronize me. I'm wondering how other people process what they're looking at. I mean, do they care? I don't know. I know I cannot watch movies that have been made in the last few years, because they're all like that. When they don't feature these digitalized heroes, you know, these sort of tiresome comic book stories, you just run into this this virtue display, and you know I I can't even watch it. The stories are terrible, and everything seems to be an excuse to feature these minorities, you know, in these programs and these situation dramas. And I just wonder if I'm the only one noticing this. You obviously notice it as well. Absolutely. I wonder how many others do.
Yeah, I there is obviously the very good development of movies not earning as much money generally as they used to, or movies that are exceptions to the woke rule doing better than ones that are more conventional. But the question is, do studios care? Obviously, they want to make money, but they also deal with the creative class, which is politically, to say the absolute least, beholden to one direction, and that's it. There are some exceptions, but pretty rare. I mean, you see what's going on with the Daily Wire crowd now. They're trying to start their own studio, and it's had some success. The question is, how much success can it feasibly have? How big would their market share be? I think it's pretty big, by the way, but you know, I just know how far it can go. So it's interesting to see what's going on, but in the establishment media, particularly the entertainment media, it's a terrible situation, and it doesn't look like a situation that's going to turn around. But I think the establishment sources, I mean, I know for a fact they're losing power with time. Less people watch them. More people watch stuff online, created content on YouTube, which is terribly censorious, or social media platforms such as Twitter. And I think that these big media studios and distribution firms, they're just not as powerful as they once were, even though they still have a lot of power, but it shrinks by the year. I was just watching something on, of all places, YouTube, several videos actually, about why Hollywood is not as influential as it once was. It's no longer the cool crowd. Movie stars don't carry the pop cultural power that they once did. As I said before, movies don't earn as much in most cases as they once did, adjusted for inflation at least. And it really is something interesting, something positive. It's not necessarily that people are looking for conservative content. What it is that they're getting tired of what they've been getting for generations on end, and there's more people now creating more things to share with people through video sharing platforms, social media websites, that the power of Hollywood erodes. That's a good thing, even though, like I said, it's not necessarily going in a conservative direction, but it's just good that these establishment entertainment media sources no longer carry the big stick which they once did. And it's really good that movie stars don't have the power which they once did. These things are positive developments in a very negative time.
Yeah, one of the things I find interesting is that Hollywood actors and actresses who were, you know, somewhat on the left but not all that radical, or whose radicalism was certainly not known to me, you know, have become like political nuisances. I suppose Barbara Streisand was always some kind of leftist. She's more extreme now. Rob Reiner has become a total maniac. I remember him as Meathead. from Archie.
All the family, yep.
But he's become a lot more obnoxious. I did not know that Robert De Niro was a flaming woke leftist, which apparently he is. I would have guessed that, sort of given his Italian background and the roles that he plays, he would be fairly conservative. That doesn't seem to be the case. I think a lot of these actors sort of just go with the flow. You know, in the 1950s, the acting profession was not particularly a leftist. And I mean, they did find the Hollywood 8 or 10 or whatever it is, you know, these communist sympathizing the communist sympathizing writers who were investigated by Congress, who, by the way, generally turned out very good movies. You know, they by contemporary standards, they were fascist reactionary movies. But, you know, you sort of go back there. I remember Irene Dunne, Adolph Manju, a whole bunch of actors. Jimmy Stewart were on the right. There were a number of actors, Walter Brennan, Adolph Manju, there were others who were John Birch Society members. And he said, well, you know, all these Jewish producers and directors are leftists. Well, Samuel Goldwyn certainly wasn't. He was a Russian Jew, very conservative. And his son-in-law, was David Selznick, made Gone with the Wind. It was quite conservative. He wrote this, you know, this heroic, he produced this heroic defense of the Confederacy.
Selznick was a Republican, by the way. Yes, Selznick? He was. Yes, he was. David O. Selznick.
Most of them were Republicans back then. Yeah. so, I mean, you know, the it's not that Hollywood was always radical. At, you know, back then, Walt Disney was very conservative.
Absolutely.
So what has happened has been a transformation of Hollywood, you know, in the last several decades. It did not start out politically where it is now, although now they make you think that everybody was, you know, a communist front writer back in the 1940s. They're all like Lillian Hellman or what's the other one, Dashiell Hammett or something, who were communist or communist. This is untrue. And I remember the most offensive loudmouth leftist back in the night, you know, Lorene Bacall and Shelley Winter. Neither of whom would seem leftist by contemporary. They would probably be watching Fox News. So, yeah, it sort of shows you the way Hollywood has changed, you know, in the last 60 to 70 years.
Absolutely, yes. You know, old school Hollywood lefties today would definitely not be thought of as being lefties at all. They were not necessarily, I think, looked at as right wingers, but they would probably be, well, actually, the lefties who demand total compliance would call them right wing fascists, but more realistically, they'd be thought of as moderates. But it's really something how Hollywood has transformed itself. And I do think this transformation, it's basically brought the studio system to not irrelevance, but it's getting close. I mean, there was that big superhero movie, and I hate superhero movies, I don't watch them. But I did hear about this film because it just did so badly. The Marvels, which was a girl power feminist superhero movie. And now it's an epic Hollywood flop released last month. It's something that's going down in history as being terrible. Audiences simply did not want it being sold. Disney was going to release Snow White next year, but they pushed it back to 2026. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a woke Snow White, which basically raised the middle finger to the traditional cartoon. And they're having to redo quite a few things in that movie now. It's really something how Hollywood, this politics, have taken to a point of self-destruction. But the question is, do people really care? Now, the people on the business end certainly care. That's why Bob Iger said he wants to go in a non-culture warrior direction, even though he himself is very much on the left. But they realize what has to be done has to be done. But the people who are involved on the creative side, the screenwriters, the actors, you know, costume designers, even these people are, I don't think, all that interested. They want to make money, don't get me wrong, but they're not always looking at the numbers. Perhaps they're not looking at the numbers most of the time. They're interested in making a statement and having prestige derived from that more than anything to do with dollars and cents.
No, I think you're right. Something which is definitely, you know, animated this sort of radical stance industry is the Trump phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was listening to Steven Spielberg and Barbara Streisand explaining how, you know, Trump is at least as bad as Hitler, maybe even worse. I mean, things are insane that they say, but you have to like listen. And I hear, you know, a lot of people saying things like this. I had a former colleague who threw me out of his office because I wouldn't admit that, you know, Trump was the second coming of Hitler. And I don't even like Trump. But obviously the left has been able to concentrate its power here and in Europe and throughout the Anglosphere too, Canada or England or Australia. I mean, what they've done is they've concentrated their fury on Trump. You know, pick up the British Guardian. It's crazier than any American newspaper in its attacks on Trump. So this is a cause. I mean, being against the Vietnam War was a cause, right? In the civil rights movement. This is the new cause. You know, protecting us against against Trumpian Hitlerism or something like that, and you know, they're all into this, and of course, what this assumes is support for the Democratic Party's agenda, the woke agenda. But they don't even think about that. It's just a matter of fighting Trump. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, Robert De Niro had a temper tantrum, maybe it was a stage one when he began. He had to speak somewhere at an Academy Award. Began attacking Trump in
Tony Awards, yeah.
Language.
Yep. He did so at the Tony Awards a few years back.
Yeah, the Tony Awards, right.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but what are you going to do? Of course, De Niro himself is having some legal and financial troubles. So talk about throwing stones from a glass house. But anyway, as we do unfortunately wind things down here, Paul, what do you think will come of woke capitalism in the end? Because obviously, if they have to be worried about, as I said, displeasing the investors while also being worried about alienating their market share of consumers, it's a very uneasy situation. So where do you think this ultimately winds up?
I think they're going to have to back down a bit, because I think this disinvestment is going to go on. And, you know, if you get Republican governments in the various states, which are not simply, Chris Sununu's government in New Hampshire, but things that are more seriously conservative, there is going to be more of this disinvestment. I think there was some boycotts, some widely featured boycotts, such as the one, you know, with Budweiser Light and what happened with Target. What happened with Disney, I think, it was a situation in which Disney took some big hits, even if DeSantis did as well. But I think that kind of thing is likely to happen again in red states. I think at the end of the day, they may have to back down, but you're still going to, it doesn't mean they're going to replace the corporate executives who are doing this. They're just going to be a little more careful, which seems to be what Budweiser Light is doing right now. The boycotts do work if everybody agrees on what they're going to boycott. And you make sure you're not really hurting some poor working class people. You know, you get the people at the top, you make them suffer if you can. So they're thrown back, you know, a few million dollars or something. But I think the boycotts have to be well chosen. The lefters are very good at organizing boycotts. I mean, they did this in India. I remember in Indiana that there was like people were not accepting the transgendered or something, and they just organized boycotts all over the state. But the right is going to have to start learning how to do this. But it's not like, you know, my boycotting giant. It's something that has to be done at a top level. It has to be well organized, and I think there should be more and more of that. In many ways, my ideal comes from the civil rights movement. The bus banning, the bus boycott in Birmingham, right, which started it. There was actually a law against striking or something, or now banning this, but it was very clever, you know, and it worked very well. But of course, they had the national press behind them and the media behind them. We don't. We're going to have them against us. But I think that kind of massive boycott that you announce, we're doing this, you give the reasons why you're doing it, and they're good reasons. I mean, they should all be boycotted, all doing the same thing, right? But you have to sort of pick your target, and then everybody has to organize and go after that target.
That's the difficult thing about strategizing a boycott. Everyone has to be on the same page, and they have to be disciplined enough to remain on that page. The left does it very well, but as you said, the right does not. The reasons for that are multifaceted and way, way too intricate to get into tonight. But I will say, Paul, there's something interesting talking about the political perspectives of companies and how they deal with politicians, and then how politicians deal with them. I was reading an article recently, and it features something from DeSantis, and it was about the anti-abortion movement, or specifically how the anti-abortion movement is beginning its backside beaten all over the place since Roe was axed. And DeSantis lamented, I believe it was in Iowa, that they have support, the Republicans, from a lot of business people who donate to the party and obviously to its candidates. When it comes to economic issues, but when it comes to the anti-abortion issue, they run in the other direction, donate to pro-choice causes. Now, he was talking about Republican donors. He's not talking about Democratic donors.
Right.
He's talking about people who are lifelong Republicans, who will support the party. They're not voting for Biden. They're not voting for him, but they're not voting for Biden. And he was angry because the left, he was saying, they get comprehensive support from their big donors. on all the issues, and that's how the left is able to have the ability to find such success in doing something like counteracting the anti-abortion movement. And I agree with him on that. And, you know, I'm definitely not a big businessman. Maybe one day we'll see. But I definitely, you know, support the Republicans. I vote Republican. But at the same time, I just signed the petition for the state's pro-choice constitutional amendment proposal. So there is definitely this thing wherein the Republicans have people who support them, either financially or with votes, but at the same time, these people don't like all the social issues, whereas on the Democratic side, the people who are loyal, either in terms of money or votes, are loyal with the economic as well as the social issues. I think this speaks to, obviously, a more unstable coalition in the GOP, though the Democratic coalition is basically just held together by hatred, but hatred can just be a very bonding thing, even if it doesn't make sense why all these groups, which have nothing in common with each other, would be together politically, if not for the hatred that they or it's more or less traditional America, especially the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, or the memory of him, because at this point, the WASP establishment, it's long gone.
It's something that needs to exist here.
Very much so. But, you know, what I'm saying is that the GOP has a fracture. And I don't think this is going to be resolved. Basically, what I think is going to happen is that certain issues just fall out of favor with people and the party moves on, and hopefully it's people will be more unified at one point or another down the road. Paul, anything to say about what I've gone on about?
Yeah, I think the division is inescapable for several reasons. One of which is the type of capitalist you describe is the type of capitalist who supports the conservative movement. Mm-hmm. So you get who are giving the money? The Murdoch family, who are super liberal on every social issue, are passionately Zionistic, you know, and in some cases vote Democratic because they're liberal on social issues. Paul Singer, who's very liberal on social issues, he gives money to the Free Beacon, some other conservative or quasi-conservative enterprises. The Koch brother, the one that's left, is a very, very leftist libertarian, you know, who's, I think right now, supporting Nikki Haley. So these are the people who give money to conservative causes. Now, Chronicles, which I'm the editor, at one time got money from very conservative, pro-tariff, small industrialists. We had one in the South who gave us money for years. There aren't too many of those people around anymore, unfortunately. I think there's also a difference between people who are on the right and on the left. And as I said, it's only half jokingly in a number of articles, I gladly trade Chuck Schumer, the guy that we have, Scott, what's his name?
John Fetterman?
Yeah, Mitch McConnell. I would gladly change Mitch McConnell for Chuck Schumer. I'd love to have Chuck Schumer on my side. I mean, if he were a right winger like me, because he's ruthless, he lies, he's a cheat, he's a conniving scoundrel, but he wins in the end, and he'll do anything to win. The other one just compromises, you know, what can I compromise on today? So, I mean, you want a fighter on your side. Even if I despise everything Schumer believes in, I even like the spirit of the squad. They fight. And do I really want, you know, to be allied to Mitt Romney? Do I want to be allied? Even Nikki Haley, I don't want her as an ally. Because she'll give the left whatever they want as long as they agree on starting some war somewhere. And so I think the left not only is motivated by hate, which they are, it's hate that keeps them together, they're also fighters. Mm-hmm. And the people on the right generally are not. And that gives the other side a tremendous advantage. I know I'm criticized all the time for saying this, but my view is if you want to be a saint, if you want to go into a monastery, do something like that. Of course, they're not going to do that. They want the best of both worlds, you know. But I mean, what they want to say, if you want to be a saint, don't enter the political arena. It's like saying, I want to be a soldier, but I don't want to fight. Well, it's, you chose the wrong profession.
Absolutely.
That is my reaction. But then you get total crazies on the Republican side, like Matt Gaetz, you know, who's going to go wild, break up the, you have like 3-4 votes on your side or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then you get all these horrible virtue signalers who got rid of George Santos. I think they're crazy. I don't know if you read my column on that. I think they're absolutely insane with this virtue signaling. But the Democrats don't do any of that.
Exactly.
They stand behind, Jamal Bowman, who was this black criminal who's a black race. They love him because he votes with them. And they didn't even want him censured. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the way they treat their scoundrels, or Eric Swalwell, or the other ones. I mean, they really stand behind him. And Maxine Waters can cheat all she wants, as head of the Finance Committee. They really stick up for their own. And, I like those people on my side. And I'll gladly give them all the virtue signalers who voted against George Santos.
No, I understand what you're saying. It's interesting. There is this behavioral distinction between the left and the right, and I think you described it very well indeed. Although, before we go, I just have to bring up the flip side of the argument with regard to the flip side of the argument that DeSantis made, because he was saying that these conservatives, or people who support fiscal conservatives, they should support the anti-abortion movement as well. But then these people would ask, well, why would I support this movement if I don't like it? And the left, they just tend to really go along with things to the extent that I don't think they question whether they like it or not. They believe in the supremacy of their side, so they'll do whatever is necessary to shore it up. But on the GOP, you definitely have more people in the way of independent thinkers, even though, of course, you have close-minded people across the political spectrum, don't get me wrong. But the GOP is more about issues than about voting blocks. The Democrats are about voting blocks. That's why they do identity politics. The GOP is much more issues-based, and people think about issues. So that means you're going to be much less united than a party that's built upon blocks that are glued together by hatred of somebody who's outside their coalition. It's a unique distinction, to say the least, but there it is. And I just have to say, obviously, in defense of Republicans such as myself, who would vote GOP, but we would not support something like, the so-called pro-life movement. There's no reason for us to support it in the first place. So the idea that we just should out of party unity is interesting, because obviously it winds up hurting the Republican Party, the anti-abortion perspective. We don't need to get into all the referenda as well as the ones that are coming up. But, that's just the way things are.
Yeah, I think, though, what you see with the Democrats and with the leftist voting bloc is that they don't really focus on what they disagree with in that leftist bloc, or they don't care about. Mm-hmm. Like most feminists I know, they don't really care about, black power or critical race theory. What they care about is fighting the patriarchy. It doesn't exist. I mean, it's a fiction of their imagination. But they want to fight the patriarchy. The blacks couldn't care less about the homosexuals. Although they're politicians who are these, leftist black women like, what's her name, Sheila Lee Jackson, and others will make a big fuss out of this, that we're gay, we're for transgender. And so, but most of the blacks don't care. What they care about is black power, and getting money from the man, and, getting paid off by the Democratic establishment to keep the other blacks in line. But they, each group, although they share a generalized hate for white male Christians, whoever you're supposed to hate, they do look after they have their own interests, but yet they work together as a coalition. So the fact that, that I have deep moral reservations about abortion, which I do, I admit that, and I am on the right on every social issue, but probably less pro-capitalist than Joseph, would not keep me from cooperating with him. Okay, I mean, but for many Republicans, it would. They are sharply divided, as you pointed out, by these issues.
Yes, indeed. And it's an unfortunate division. I wish that everybody could just get along, but, that's far easier said than done. Basically, that's that. So, it'll be interesting to see what comes of Obviously, Trump's going to win the nomination. We should see what comes of the election in terms of economic stances and how most people in the GOP react to whatever those stances are. That's really going to be something else. Paul, we are bringing the conversation finally to an end. I'm glad we got the chance to discuss a few more things. Oh, just one last question, given what we were just talking about. This isn't about my view on anything, but do you think that DeSantis is sincere in the issues that he promotes during his presidential campaign?
Yes, I do. No, I think he staked a lot on this. And he is the Republican presidential candidate I respect the most, because I do think he's principled, and I generally agree with his principles.
Got it.
I would vote for Donald Trump reluctantly if he was a nominee. Or perhaps less reluctantly, I'd vote for Vivek.
No, obviously, I will vote for Trump in the primary, but I would vote for Vivek over Ron. But it's just interesting because I posed the question earlier and on Twitter whether or not DeSantis is sincere in his presidential campaign. I just wanted to get your perspective. I'm glad that perspective has been gained. Now, finally, the conversation is at its end. Paul, I trust you enjoyed this chat as much as I did.
No, I did. Despite our difference on the abortion issue, I think we're generally like-minded and have the same views on other things.
It's great that we are able to discuss all this. I look forward to our next discussion, and I hope that your cough is remedied as quickly as possible.
No, it's some sinus condition that just will not go away. I've had this about 3 months, and I think it may be a dust allergy, which is aggravating the my sinuses.
I have similar problems. I always have, so I sympathize. And everyone, thank you very much for having tuned in tonight. I trust you got as much out of this chat as Paul and I did. Please stay safe, be well, and cheers.